From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Katherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA Executive Producer. Welcome, Katherine and Steve.
Good to be here.
Same here. Glad to be with you.
Well, here are the issues. Democratic senators have signaled they will accept a proposal by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to raise the debt limit for 2 months to avoid a potential economic crisis. President Joe Biden continues to promote his legislative priorities on infrastructure and social spending. The two bills face a stalemate in Congress as members of Biden's own Democratic Party continue to wrangle over the size and scope of the package. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris in an effort to repair damage to relations caused by excluding America's oldest ally from a new Indo-Pacific security initiative. A Facebook whistleblower appeared before a Senate panel that was already fired up about the recent wave of revelations about the company. A Wall Street Journal report cites internal knowledge of Facebook's harmful effects and the company's reticence to act. The Biden administration is boosting COVID-19 testing in the U.S. with additional investment in at-home rapid tests. This as federal and local vaccine requirements are in place to help curb the surge of COVID-19 cases, but not without opposition. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Katherine, Senate Democrats insisted they would not back down to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in a high-stakes standoff over the federal debt limit, saying there was no way they'd use the lengthy budget reconciliation process to raise the debt ceiling. However, it appears they will accept a deal that would prevent a default. So what type of form is this short-term solution?
I think what's important to remember here is that Democrats were able to leverage the threat of the filibuster in the sense that Mitch McConnell does not want to see that blown up, that 60-vote threshold that would really allow Democrats to pass even more legislation. And there have been some rumblings on Capitol Hill this week that if the debt limit issue was not resolved in time, then Democrats would go ahead and have more support to be able to do that. That was something that was able to make Mitch McConnell push back down, make a deal on this, and really reach a compromise that had bedeviled them in the weeks before, that it almost threatened to shut down the U.S. government before they were able to pass that clean CR, the continuing resolution that will fund the government through December. All of those different elements coming into play really helped them reach this short-term deal.
The lifting of the debt ceiling and being able to reach this deal, the Democrats are calling it a win, and that McConnell, the Republican leader, caved on them. But the real reason for raising the debt limit is so that the United States can pay its bills, pay its past debts, not so much future spending, but past spending. And if the United States doesn't pay its bills, doesn't pay the interest on the bonds that it is issued for that debt, then that would likely cause a global economic crisis, and that nobody really wants to have, including Republicans, because they could be seen as creating this. So now that this little issue has been overcome, Democrats still have a lot of work to do in order to get their spending priorities out, and they've got to deal with that themselves since they have the majorities in both houses of Congress.
Also, and just to mention some of the things that could actually happen absent congressional action, a default threatens to unleash widespread financial havoc, as you pointed out, but it could rattle markets, delay seniors' Social Security checks, prevent some families from receiving monthly child tax assistance, and raise the cost of borrowing for millions of Americans by driving up interest rates. Also, Fitch Ratings said that a default would likely cost the U.S. its AAA credit rating and raise serious questions about the country's ability to anchor the global financial system. So this really sounds like a doomsday scenario. And could this still happen?
Unlikely. It's never happened before. Both the Democrats and the Republicans understand, as you laid out, the fiscal cliff that they would all be jumping off if they let this debt ceiling expire and the United States couldn't legally pay its debts. So right now, everybody is kind of exhaling, but there's still a lot of heavy breathing to be done as Democrats try to get their budget in order.
That's right. And this is a point that I've seen happen several times in my time up on Capitol Hill, where we'll approach this fiscal cliff and everyone understands, as you mentioned, the incredibly high stakes of defaulting on that, and steps back and finds a way to make a deal with each other. We really have not ever approached that point where we've gone over that cliff, or at least not yet.
And looking at President Biden and his trip this week to Michigan, where he's trying to build public support for his domestic agenda, he said that he wanted to make sure it was a package that everyone could agree on. But he also said it's not going to be $3.5 trillion. It's going to be less than that. So where do progressives and moderates stand on this reduction in spending?
So there's an understanding on Capitol Hill that the reconciliation package that would fund a broad range of social policy programs, taking in healthcare funding, funding for early childhood education and community college, climate change jobs, you know, clean energy jobs, a whole range of issues. There's an understanding that that $3.5 trillion number is just not going to happen, and it's probably going to be much closer to a $2 trillion price tag. And that's upsetting some progressives in the U.S. House of Representatives, where, of course, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has very narrow margins to pass any kind of legislation. She needs to get their buy-in to be able to get it through the U.S. House. Those negotiations are ongoing. Progressives are working with moderates to see exactly what they can get in that bill, and that can then get through the U.S. Senate, where, of course, the margins are even closer for Democrats.
Will Rogers was a legendary American humorist, and he once said, "I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat." And 85 years after he said that, it still seems pertinent. The Democrats have been arguing among themselves since late spring about how much to spend, what to spend it on, how much to tax people, and who should pay more taxes. And the split is really between a smaller group of moderate centrist Democrats who fear that large spending will be used against them in future campaigns, and against the larger majority of Democrats who are pushing for larger spending, a larger social safety net for Americans. And what I think is most important in their minds is really working on climate change and doing the things and spending the money necessary to try to bring the amount of pollutants down and to spur green energy industries. And that's where the biggest rub is. It's mostly how much to spend and how they come to some sort of agreement has been now months in the making, and still seems they may be getting closer, but how long it's going to be before they come to an agreement is anybody's guess.
That's right. And time is really running out here, because you only have a handful of weeks left in legislative session in the year 2021, and they've only kicked the can down the road in terms of government funding. They're going to reach that issue again in mid-December when this continuing resolution expires. And well, you'll hear Democrats always say up on Capitol Hill, you know, the beauty of our party is in its diversity. Eventually, you do have to bring that diversity of opinions together and deliver a legislative win for President Biden in the first year of his presidential term.
Yes, those are some very good points that you brought up. And I guess we'll just have to see, as you pointed out, all this diversity, is it going to come together? On now to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who was working to repair relations with France that were rocked by the Biden administration's new defense partnership with the U.K. and Australia. A senior State Department official described Blinken's official encounter in Paris as very productive and forward-looking, but both the U.S. and the French agreed that work remains to mend this relationship. Catherine, what is the overall picture of this relationship now?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that Secretary of State Blinken has a very close relationship with France. He lived there for a decade. He speaks French fluently. I think this is probably one of the very last things he expected to be dealing with in the first year of the Biden presidency, is a rift with America's oldest ally. He was warmly welcomed there earlier this summer. And now that he's going there again, he is, of course, the right person, the ideal person, to smooth over this diplomatic tiff that actually resulted in France temporarily recalling its ambassador from the U.S. He'll be able to smooth over that little rift, talk it out, use his knowledge of the French language, the French country, to be able to build back those bridges.
The issue specifically is over submarines. And the French had to deal with the Australians to sell them a bunch of diesel-powered submarines. And the U.S. and Britain now negotiated a deal with the Australians for nuclear-powered submarines. And all of that is part of the U.S. desire to contain China in the Indo-Pacific, and it's part of the U.S. effort to compete with China. Blinken told a French TV station that the U.S. could have and should have done better in terms of communicating with France over the issue. And as Catherine mentioned, France is America's oldest ally, having come to America's defense in the Revolutionary War against Great Britain. So eventually, this little hiccup, this little fracture in the relationship will be smoothed over. How it is going to be done through diplomatic channels. But ultimately, this issue isn't so much about a U.S.-French issue, but it's about a U.S.-China and U.S. allies and China in trying to contain China's expansionist outlook and movement in that area of the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean.
Yes, that is true. And also, I'm glad you brought up how the rift actually began. It was over the French submarines, and it was a defense contract that was initially valued at $40 billion. So that's quite a sum of money. And as you pointed out, perhaps France will be able to get over this and looking at the big picture as to what this alliance was trying to do. But will they be able to really focus on future cooperation in other matters?
I think they pretty much have to. The French, the U.S., and the British are aligned very closely with NATO. There are all kinds of defense treaties among those three countries and Australia. So I do think this is a diplomatic blip that will eventually be smoothed over. How it is, it probably will be some sort of financial restitution to what France will have lost in their submarine deal with Australia. But overall, I think as far as the upper level diplomacy and the upper level cooperation among those three countries, it's pretty much going to remain the same.
Okay, well, it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, a tough hearing before Congress for a social media giant, Facebook. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists who are joining me via Skype, Catherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive producer. Catherine, in the latest congressional hearing on Facebook, Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen's unique position as a recent former employee not speaking on behalf of the company was in full display during her testimony. She was able to give clear explanations of technical terms like meaningful social interactions or engagement-based rankings that have gotten muddled in the past. So how credible is her testimony and what impact will it have on Facebook?
You know, I've covered a number of congressional hearings with Facebook executives in the past few years, most of them focusing on the way the platform influenced the 2016 election and subsequent elections that really has a lot of lawmakers concerned about the way social media is impacting our democracy. This hearing this week really stood out in terms of Frances's way of giving an inside view into the company. I think it's really one of the first times we've heard from someone up on Capitol Hill who displayed the way the social media platform's algorithm works in all of its warts, all of its bad sides, and the way that that algorithm favors likes and favors engagement in a way that actually doesn't match reality, but amplifies misinformation, amplifies the negative, amplifies everything that's bad about social media. And of course, she came backed up with documents to support that, research, analytics, that really made an impression on lawmakers, I think, who already were united behind this idea of finding a way to really limit and regulate social media companies moving forward. That's something that unusually has both Democratic and Republican support. And I think this was really a galvanizing moment for that effort.
And it wasn't just the research that was presented. This is Facebook's research. This is research known among the upper levels and even the lower levels of Facebook, that its content and the algorithms that help perpetuate that content and bring it to your feed or someone else's feed is divisive, it's polarizing, and in her words, easy to inspire people to anger than it is to other emotions. And this is Facebook's own research, and she pointed out that Facebook ignored that research and continues to tweak its algorithm to be able to engage and try and keep those people who are using Facebook on that platform. Part of it is also a political issue, that most of the politicians in that room who are hearing her testimony, they use Facebook for their own campaigning and get their own messages out. So this is one of the reasons it's being difficult for American politicians to figure out exactly how to regulate not only Facebook, but other tech giants.
And, you know, one of the ways forward that's been discussed on Capitol Hill for quite some time is in a new approach to Section 230, which is a section of the federal law that basically has been called the law that birthed the internet, that really allowed the internet to flourish because it protects internet companies and, of course, social media companies from liability for the content posted on their platforms. And that has really shielded companies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram from responsibility for what goes on their platforms. And I think the way forward in terms of lawmaker thinking is that there really has to be a renewed look, a new approach to this law. There have to be carve-outs that address some of these issues that are coming up in terms of the harmful content posted on social media.
Yes, and also Senator said that Facebook CEO and co-founder Mark Zuckerberg should testify before the committee. Again, given Hogan's testimony, Subcommittee Chairman Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut, said Zuckerberg needs to respond to why he rejected seemingly worthwhile recommendations as revealed through documents Hogan released. Do you think that Zuckerberg will testify again, and what can we expect from him as a response?
Well, I think we definitely can expect Zuckerberg to testify again. Whether that testimony will be of any use or will provide lawmakers with any additional information, he has been up on Capitol Hill multiple times in the last few years testifying about the impact of the platform on the 2016 election, about harmful political content on his platform. And there's, you know, been a real give and take. Some lawmakers don't actually understand how the platform worked, so their questions weren't terribly pertinent. And Zuckerberg was often able to say, I want to address this. The company is working to address this. We want to work with Congress. But really, when it gets down to it, gets down to the details, what is that going to mean? What are they actually going to show up and do in terms of addressing this problem?
One of the moments of testimony from Zuckerberg over the last couple of years that really stuck with me was a question about what Facebook's, what kind of business it's in. And Zuckerberg simply answered by saying, we're in a business to sell ads. And that's really what Facebook and many of these other social media networks are. They're an opportunity, much like radio and television, to sell advertising to the people who use the platform. What the difference is between radio and television and these social media giants is The social media giants have a really good idea of who their audience is, and they're able to tweak their algorithms to be able to feed various different stories to the audience out there that gets them to stay longer, listen longer, read longer, use the platform longer. And much of that is content that creates emotional attachment. And that is what Zuckerberg faces when next time he goes up to Capitol Hill, is questions about what is that platform trying to sell.
On now to our last topic. Many organizations have implemented federal and local vaccine mandates over the past several weeks to help curb the surge of COVID cases. However, there is opposition to the vaccine mandates. For example, a New York State mandate that all healthcare workers be vaccinated with no religious exemptions has sparked multiple legal challenges and fear of staffing shortages. Some students have reportedly withdrawn from college due to the mandates. First, do you all see the mandates working, and do those who oppose the vaccine have a right to not get vaccinated?
Well, the government is still working on exactly how to make the vaccine mandate work. There's a devil in the details here. Is you have a mandate, are you mandating this for companies with freelance employees in addition to full-time employees? Who is paying for the testing if people opt out of that vaccine mandate? Is it the company themselves, the employee, the government? And how exactly do you get people to take the vaccine? As you mentioned, do people have a right to say no to this? Of course, there's been a long ongoing discussion in this country during the coronavirus pandemic about whether or not people have a societal debt to get the vaccine for each other, to contribute to the common good versus the cause of individual liberty. And that's a tension that's not going to be resolved anytime soon, and that's going to be playing out as the Biden administration tries to push this vaccine mandate.
And I look at Los Angeles. They became the first city to require proof of vaccination. You got to show your vaccination card to do almost anything indoors. Go to a restaurant, a concert, even go shopping in the mall. You need to show proof of vaccination. And I think various different mandates like this, employer mandates, United Airlines has let go of a few pilots and a few employees. But for the most part, when United Airlines says every employee must be vaccinated, many who weren't did get vaccinated. So I think what the president is trying to do, his strategy seems to be pressure the employers to have their employees, whether they're freelance, whether they're staff employees, make them be vaccinated if they want to come back to work. That seems to be working in some places, but there still is a long way to go to get enough people vaccinated to create what they call herd immunity, which we're still well far away from here in the United States.
One of the latest initiatives coming out of the White House is the U.S. is set to invest $1 billion, which will go towards the purchase of rapid at-home COVID tests to further mobilize testing manufacturers to bring more to the market. So how significant will this be for people to be able to test for COVID at home and curb outbreaks of COVID?
I think this is going to be incredibly helpful in increasing access and increasing the ease. There's just among people I know somewhat of a misunderstanding of how quickly and easily you can obtain rapid testing. This will help people get back out there, traveling, shopping, getting back to normal life. And I just wanted to add one point is that in terms of the vaccine mandate, there's also going to be the issue of boosters. You know, a lot of people in the U.S. are now in that third round of getting a booster shot for the COVID vaccine. And it's going to be an open question as to whether those companies need to mandate the booster in addition to that first and second round of COVID vaccines. That's going to be an additional wrinkle in the Biden administration's plan.
Just one other item as far as the testing is concerned. The White House is also going to expand the number of COVID testing sites around the country to administer the more accurate PCR testing, which will also go to help create a larger sense of confidence that people can go out and mingle and go back to life as normal without the fear of either catching or spreading COVID.
Yes, well said. And we'll have to close on that note. My thanks to our panelists, Catherine Gibson, VOA congressional correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive producer. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.